I'm Bob Fisher. I'm an alcoholic. Feel a little more comfortable. I almost feel like I'm in church with the back row is filled up out there and folks scattered around. I was at a meeting a number of years ago in Austell. Austell's a little town over here, a little west of here, halfway between here and Birmingham. And a fellow was just getting sober. He'd just come out of the woods too, I think, and he stopped me one time after a meeting and he said, "Can I ask you something personal?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I guess so. I'll have to answer it." And he said, "Ain't you some kind of preacher?" And I said, "Yeah, I guess so." He said, "How'd you get to be an alcoholic?" And I said, "Drinking liquor." He said, "Oh." And I got to be an alcoholic by drinking too much liquor over too long a period of time. And I drank my share. I drank a bunch of it. I think he was probably coming out of somewhat of a more fundamentalist background than Episcopalians. I happen to be an Episcopalian. And I don't know if you know much about Episcopalians, but we sort of say that any time you find four Episcopalians together, you're going to find a pit. And it's probably true. Episcopalians are known to not only think that drinking is evil, I think that they think it's a requirement to join the church. I had this lady one time that was in my confirmation class, and she told some friends of hers she was going to become an Episcopalian, and a friend looked at her and said, "Why, Tony, I didn't even know you drank." But it is not a requirement for membership, although it's not one of those things that we typically feel like is a great sin. A lot of these things gave me a lot of trouble in trying to get sober. I didn't have the type of guilt and remorse about drinking that many people have, of feeling guilty about drinking. But I had a lot of remorse and failure because I wasn't able to drink. I sort of thought that was one of the things that was expected of me in my profession, was to be able to hold my liquor. And I could no longer do that. So it was one of those things that stood in my way. I never know really where to start one of these things in telling my story of what it was like when I was drinking and what happened to me and what it's been like since. I'm going to tell you that I was a little bit about my background. I was born and raised here in Atlanta. This is Smyrna here, but Atlanta's not too far away, in this area. People look at me and say, "You mean you've been in Atlanta all your life?" And I said, "Not yet." I hope not yet, anyway. I think I've got a lot of life left in me. At least I've got a lot of life left in me since I got sober. And incidentally, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since July the 4th, 1975. That's a long time between drinks, by the grace of God. And Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have not found it necessary to take a drink. And up until that time, I found it necessary to drink every day. I found it necessary to drink all the time. I was one of those kind of drinkers that I label a periodic drinker. You all know what a periodic drinker is? That's one that, drinks and has a period of sobriety. Well, I was a periodic drinker, and my periods of drinking were about every hour. I would get up in the morning and drink, and I would drink all day long, and then at night I'd get serious about it, and that's part of the next day. In the last 10 years of my drinking, I did not have a sober time at all. I even went to the hospital for a little surgery on my nose that had the bone inside was crooked or something. They had to operate, and I was going to be there the whole day. So I took a quart of whiskey with me, and I drank before the night of surgery, and I drank when I went home. I didn't even quit drinking to have surgery. So that's the kind of drinker I was. I was born here in Atlanta and raised in a normal home, what we call normal, as any home might be. Had a mother and a father and a brother and a sister and a dog, which is about as normal as you can get, I guess. And everything was pretty much level all the way through my childhood, except like most alcoholics, most people, I think. I don't know whether alcoholics are any different or not, but always feeling different and alone and left out and not totally a part of things. I don't know if that had anything to do with pre-alcoholism or just being somebody who had normal life problems way back then, but I did have a lot of them. I was a slow learner, had some learning difficulties, learning disabilities, which I didn't learn very well in early school. I was also very, very small, which, getting sober, I haven't grown any, I'm still very small. And in this American culture of ours, these things always tended to create some sort of inferiority and lack of being enough of whatever people expected you to be in this our world. So I had those normal feelings of inadequacy and inferiority and things that I think we all grew up with. And I don't really think any of this had anything to do with my alcoholism, except that when I did begin to drink and discover alcohol, I discovered that I no longer had the feelings of inadequacy and inferiority as great as I had when I was sober. So I think that the alcohol did for me a lot of things that I wanted it to do. But the thing is, alcohol does this for everybody. Alcohol is well designed as a mind-altering drug to make almost anybody who drinks it not feel the pains of life and the hurts of life. And some of us, for some reason or other, begin to live that way in this dream world that is induced by mind-altering drugs. And I certainly was one of those. But through my early childhood, we can say it's fairly basically normal with all of the successes and failures that most of us go through in life. And I didn't drink in high school. I got out of there and went off to college, and I began to drink when I went to college, like you're supposed to do, I suppose. I went off to a little college up in the mountains of Tennessee, known as the University of the South, or Swanee. I discovered two things. One, that I was not mentally equipped to be in that place. It's a very, very hard school. It's a very academic school, very scholarly school. And I was never known for scholastic achievements, but nevertheless, I ended up there. This did not help my feelings of inferiority or inadequacy at all. But nevertheless, I did stay there 4 years, and I got out. And I was even in the top half of the class somehow. I drank occasionally there, but not a great deal. But I should have known, and there were signs and flags that would come out that I later think back and remember of things that happened in those college years. That when I drank differently than other people. When I drank, I tended to get drunk, and I tended to pass out. Even so much that people would try and say things, but you never hear them. And I can remember a fraternity brother of mine mentioning to me that his girlfriend who had come up for a party weekend had mentioned to him, "Why does Bob Fisher always tend to drink and get drunk so?" And he was trying to give me a message then that there was something different about the way I drank. I didn't see it that way. I just drank, and I didn't know how to handle my liquor, I thought, and I would get drunk. But there were differences there in the way we did things. So I finished there and went into the Air Force. And I know today that when I went into the Air Force, I started drinking alcoholically, and I was in the Air Force for 2 years. And I drank alcoholically for the 2 years that I was in the Air Force. Here again, I had some money for a change, which I never had when I was in college. And I was also not under the pressure of having to study all the time. And I also didn't have a whole lot to do. I don't know if you ever, in ROTC, I turned down my commission and went in as enlisted man, but then they made me an officer a short time later. And they don't let second lieutenants do anything. So I discovered that it was my job to stay at the officer's club and entertain folks. So I did that. I was a squadron adjutant or something. I was also an intelligence officer for a while, in intelligence. Did some neat stuff when I was there. Primarily, I spent 2 years in the officer's club drinking. And I spent those 2 years drinking alcoholically, as I know today. But it hadn't gained enough control of me yet that I couldn't stop. Because I got out of the Air Force and immediately went to Austin, Texas, where I spent the next 4 years in seminary trying to learn something about Godology or theology and the Bible and all of that sort of stuff and how to go play church. So I spent 4 years studying Greek and Hebrew and the Bible and history and philosophy and psychology and everything else that you have to study there. I'm educated far beyond my intelligence, as you've probably already noticed. But anybody that spends that much time in school to make a little more money than I do, it can't be too smart. But let me take this thing out. Somebody watch off or use it to notes or people find it. Story about a fellow went to the Episcopal Church with his friend. We have a lot of symbolism. We got a lot of, you know, bells and smells and all of this sort of symbolism that we use in the church. And so he's asking, what does this mean? What does that mean? And all of this. To it. So the next Sunday, he went to the Baptist church with him. And the preacher got up and pulled his watch off and put it up there on the podium. And the man says, what does that mean? He said, not a damn thing. I'm going to take my watch off and I'm going to put it here. I don't know if it'll mean anything or not. I'll try and finish talking before y'all quit listening. And I'll try and finish as close to 9 o'clock as I can because I know this is a visiting night. Many of you have families and friends here that you want to spend a little time with. So those 2 years I was drinking alcoholically but no real problem. Because I wasn't expected to do much anyway, so I got out and went to seminary. And here again, with the shortage of money and brains, because it was very difficult school, I spent the next 4 years drinking very little or none at all. Most of my time was spent in studying and trying to pass. The times there were similar back like when I'd been in college. So the times that I did drink, I tended to get drunk. And I can remember two episodes. They were both involved with a professor of ethics, Kelly Barnett, who once had a visitor in town, and he was entertaining him at his house with a dinner and a beer party, and some of us from his class were invited to the dinner and beer party, and I got drunk at the professor of ethics house. And later, in my senior year, Kelly took us down to Houston to see how the industry works or something. I don't remember very much about it. We were guests at Dow Chemical Company for a week and sort of sat in board meetings and things like that. And I almost left seminary and wanted to see if I could get a job at Dow Chemical Company. I discovered that they have bars in the conference rooms in all the offices, and at least at that time in Dow Chemical Company, they drank a lot. And so I spent a week learning how industry works and how our powers that make society run live, and they lived on alcohol, and I liked that, and I stayed drunk for that week. Somehow that didn't affect my grades for some reason. I don't know why. I did get through. I left seminary and went to Arkansas, where I had been in the Air Force. I'd gotten out of the Air Force in Arkansas, Little Rock, so I went back there after I left seminary, rather than come back to Atlanta, because, you know, there's something about us alcoholics that are perfectionists, and we're extremely moralistic sorts of folks, and we're also very idealist, by and large, I've discovered, not just me. And we're also crusaders, and we think that we're God sometimes, and I think that being in the church is a good place to play all of those parts out, and I certainly did. And so I went to Arkansas because in those days, Arkansas was where the action was. I don't know if you'll remember, but that's where the big National Guard was called out for the integration of the high school in Little Rock, Arkansas, and that's where the sit-ins and the restaurants in Pine Bluff were. That's where the marches were. That's where the action was. And so that's where I lived. And I got involved with all of the action of the early civil rights movement. I was going to change the world. I was going to make some marks on the world. I wanted to do that. I know today that militancy and things of this nature may be necessary at times and are good, but I know today from my own looking at myself, I was not doing these things for any other reason than to build my own ego and to build my own godliness and my own business of trying to change the world and things of that nature, which are not all good motives for doing good things. And so I know today that a lot of the things I did not have good motives. They had motives to make me feel better about myself and please me. And the bottom line was not very much could make me feel good about me, but feeling good about me from another source that I later learned and gained from the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. In the first few years of trying to run churches in Arkansas, or what I call play church. You know, folks run off and get married and they go play house. And I look back today and I say that you finish seminary and you run off and you play church. And that's what you do when you play church. I'm still playing church today. I have a little church over in Austell where I play church. And I've got all the toys. If you're going to play church, you've got to have all the toys to play with. So I've got a sanctus bell and incense pot and all the stuff that's nice. Fancy vestments and all. I got all the toys to play church well with, and so I enjoy playing church. I think I play it a little differently today than I did years ago. It has some different sorts of meaning for me and some different sorts of places where I want to be and where I am today than it used to, but it's still kind of fun to enjoy what you're doing and to have some meaning in it, so I do that in my life. In that area, I think is very fulfilling. I didn't drink much during those first 3 years or so in Arkansas. I drank occasionally, but not very much because I was busy playing church and saving the world. That was my primary job in life. I sort of got tired there and decided to move back to Georgia. My parents were both in ill health. I felt like I better come back. So that I could spend some time here before they died, which I'm thankful to tell you that I did because both had died within 4 years after my return to Georgia. I went to a little town east of Atlanta called Monroe, Georgia. I don't know if any of you are familiar with Monroe, Georgia. Let me tell you, if you ever want to go back to drinking, I think that's one of the finest places in the world to get alcoholic, or at least it was for me. Because I went there, it was a very small but wealthy church, which involved a lot of social activities and cocktail parties and things of this nature. So it was there in Monroe that I resumed my drinking career in full fashion. And I think within, as I look back today, I didn't know it then, but as I look back today, I was a full-blown practicing alcoholic within 1 year after I moved to Monroe, Georgia. Because there I began to drink on a regular basis. There I began to feel that I had to stop and have a bar in my home, because you never can tell when some of these folks might come by your house to have a drink. They never did, but you know, I never know when they might. So you better have a full stock bar. There's also a dry county, too, and this helps out every time you went to Atlanta. In case you wouldn't run out, you better buy a whole case. And so I'd buy a case every time I went to Atlanta. So not only did I have a bar, but I had a well-stocked bar. kind of a spot. Oh, I don't know if any of you ever lived in a dry county like that, but you also know that you might get some bad liquor, so you better drink some of it on your way home in case some of it's bad and you have to take it back. So I began to drink some coming home, too. At any rate, I began to drink, not like I was in the later, but I began drinking on a daily basis and eating it. I also discovered something wonderful about being a pastor. Go out and visit folks. And in Monroe, they had the Ladies' Aid Society would have tea parties in town. And let me tell you something. The ladies did not drink tea at their tea parties. They generally had martinis or wine. And I could ride through the subdivisions there in Monroe, and I could see where the cars were parked, and I knew where they were having their tea parties. And so I'd drop by to make one of my pastoral visitations on this little tea party. What I was basically doing was getting my afternoon fix. I used to joke about it. I said, you know, I'm coming. I'm taking care of your spiritual needs while you're taking care of mine. And there's a lot of truth in that because it got to the point where I needed an afternoon fix. And my spiritual needs were getting in pretty bad shape. I stayed in Monroe for a while. And that's one thing. Alcohol enables us to do so many things during the early years of our drinking. And I was there in a small church, and I didn't have a whole lot to do. So I started helping out with a church down in Madison, and that wasn't enough. So I also started a church in Winder and another church in Conyers. I wasn't there but 2 years. And both of those churches are still in existence today that I birthed during my budding alcohol days, because it does give you a lot of energy and a lot of momentum to go and do things and get things started. And I did those things. But I came to Atlanta because I, back to my business of saving the world, and came to a little church in the Grant Park area of Atlanta, or inner city, because here again, I was God, you realize. I had this Messiah complex of trying to save the world, and where else can you save it rather than go into the inner city? So I spent the next 5 years in the inner city with a little church that flourished and did well. In fact, it did better when I was there during the 5 years than it did in its previous 90 years history, or it's done since I left. But it almost killed me at the same time, and I also began to drink more and more, and I drank alcoholically for those 5 years, I know today. I look back on these things. I didn't know I was doing it at the time, as none of us realized in our early days of drinking that we're really drinking alcoholically or we're getting in trouble with it. Even though during those years I was beginning to get up in the morning and start drinking during the day, and even though during those years I was beginning to carry a flask in my pocket and one over the seat of my car to have a little bit during the day, I really didn't think I was getting in any trouble with it, because at that point, I could not drink if I decided to, well, maybe getting in a little trouble, so I could dispense with drinking for a while and control it. I could have controlled drinking. That's one of the things people will say sometimes when you ask them what an alcoholic is, and they say, an alcoholic, somebody can't control their drinking. I say, that's so. Alcoholic is an expert at controlled drinking. Let me tell you, I was full drinker. I knew how to do it. I had 10 years of practice, and I did it well. I knew how to control my drinking. And I think every alcoholic did know how to control his drinking and could control his drinking up to a point. But if knowledge and practice would enable me to continue control drinking, I'd still be drinking today. But of course, we would go over that curve, and we'd fall off that mountain, or go down that roller coaster, whatever it is that we call it, and there's no more control drinking after that. But up until that point, we're experts at control drinking. We know how to do it. We can do it well. Let's see. I'm leaving out a whole bunch of stuff in here. The blackouts. I didn't think I had any blackouts when I went into treatment. They said, Bob, you ever had any blackouts? I said, no, not me. But after I'd been sober, I realized now that I was living in a blackout most of the time. I had a very black out the very first time I drank when I went off to Tennessee to college. My old roommate from Nashville came through Atlanta, and we went out to lunch, and I'd been sober about 2 years at the time. We were reminiscing old times, and he said, "Never will forget that day when the pledge turned in at the beer party, and you got up on the mountain and talked to Robert E. Lee." I don't remember that. I remember him talking about somebody getting on the mountain and talking to Robert E. Lee, but I didn't know it was me. Then when I was in Monroe, or a little time after I left Monroe, summer before last, there was a little gal, a little kid when I was in Monroe, and she was getting married. Start realizing your age when you start marrying those that you baptized. And she wanted me to do the wedding with real close friends and family, and discussing the wedding. And she said, "Oh, Monday visited me. Spent the week with me last week." I said, "That was nice. I'm sure you enjoyed that." She said, "Yeah." Now, Mubby was her grandmother, and Mubby had been a very close friend of mine, too. And she said, "Oh, Snooks died." And I said, "Snooks, who's Snooks?" And she said, "Oh, that was her husband." I said, "Oh, she got married." The last I remember, Mubby was a divorcee. She said, "Oh, she got married." She said, "Yeah, you married." And Mubby says she owes my wedding better than hers when groom, best man, and preacher were all drunk. I don't remember that Mubby's wedding. But evidently, Mubby got married, and I was there. So you see, I was having blackouts. I just didn't know it because nothing had ever occurred to called to memory that I didn't remember what had happened. Or did I discount it? Some other maybe pertinent facts. They are pertinent. I need to bring them in along the way. While I was in seminary, I got married. I married a girl that I had known when I was in the Air Force in Little Rock, who had never seen me sober. Because she met me when I was in the Air Force drinking, and anytime she would see me when I would leave the seminary for a weekend or something, drive to Little Rock, I was drinking, so I was drunk. And she'd never seen me sober when we got married. I certainly wasn't sober when I got married either. Probably wouldn't have done such a foolish thing. At any rate, she had never seen me sober. She moved to Little Rock with me, Texas, to finish school there. Didn't see much of me there either because I was studying, but at any rate. After we got to Arkansas, we had a son. We adopted another one in Arkansas. We moved to Georgia and had another one, and then another one after I moved to Atlanta. So I ended up with four sons. And this is important because it plays an integral part of my recovery, what's happened to the four boys. But at any rate, I left the inner city and I went to North Atlanta to the Good Life, to St. Martin's Church as the assistant there, which is the second largest Episcopal church in Atlanta. Here again, back in social life, in social church, and a lot of drinking, a lot of cocktail partying, I became a full-blown alcoholic there the next 5 years that I spent at St. Martin's. I got into a lot of scrapes and trouble with the church because of my drinking. I was warned several times that I needed to do something about my drinking. Episcopalians don't mind drinking. They think you ought to show up to services sober. I don't know. They're kind of weird like that. But the bottom line of it was, what happened was I got fired. And I was unemployed, and I was unemployed at that point. Incidentally, this does not happen in the church today. We have rules and practices against that people are not fired for being alcoholics in the church. But 13 years ago, they sure were, at least in this diocese. And so I was in pretty bad shape. I tried AA and tried to get sober, and I didn't for a long time. I would go to AA meetings. I ended up in Peaceford Hospital. And spent Well, I was able to finish that 28-day program in just 5 weeks since I was so smart and knew so much about the disease. And that was the first stay at Petersburg. 2 months later, I went back into Petersburg and I spent 8 weeks for my second stay at Petersburg. If they had had the halfway houses and the professional programs that they have today, I would certainly qualify for them and I needed them. But I did go through Petersburg Hospital and I began to get dry at the same time. And I stayed very close to AA and very close to the people. Fortunately, I was unemployed, so I had a lot of free time on my hand, and I practically lived at the Naval Club in North Carolina. I'd go to the morning meeting and then eat lunch there and sit around and talk to people in the afternoon, and then go to the evening meeting. I stayed there most of the time. I stayed very, very close within the AA community, and I think today that's the reason that I'm sober, is that I didn't try and get out there alone, and I didn't isolate myself, but I stayed very, very close. I was afraid to go out anywhere else. They'd given me a severance pay of 6 months' pay, so my salary was still coming in somewhat, and I was still looking for a job. I looked for a job for a long time. I never found one. I still haven't found one. I remained unemployed for a long time. I started to come out to Austell, where I still have the church. This new services on weekends. It was a very dying church with about 10 or 15 people there on Sundays, and so they paid me to come out and have Sunday services and do a little bit more. I made my living. I got a job minimum wage clerking at Sears. I got up at 2 o'clock in the morning and had a Constitution paper out. I did that for a couple of 3 years. I did anything I could legally to support my four boys and my wife, who was not able to work. She's never been very well in a lot of ways. She was in and out of a lot of mental hospitals as well as physical hospitals. But so I had the responsibility of doing all that. And we had food stamps. And I know what it is to get food stamps to live on through those years. They were not a lot of what I could call fun years, but they were profitable years for me. They were things that I needed for my own ego in order to get sober. Because, you know, my ego was so full-blown and so out of reality of what was going on that I could have never gotten sober if I had not had some times like that. That's where one of the things that has become one of the mainstays in my whole sobriety program came into being, and this was during that period, and it was that I began to develop some gratitude. Began to develop some gratitude out of the midst of some of the really rough times in life. And I can remember sitting down to dinner one night and saying grace or saying the blessing. And all of a sudden, I had a feeling of being grateful that there was food on the table. Because I was in a position where I wasn't always sure there was going to be food on the table, and I was feeling grateful that there was food on the table. And it was a feeling that came to me that I'd experienced over and over again in sobriety, a feeling of gratitude. And I discovered at that particular time that I had never been grateful for anything in my whole life. And I really hadn't. I'd always either expected it as something that I deserved, or that I could earn and get for my own, but I had never experienced gratitude for anything in my life. And from that, of course, a person that's not grateful, I was also envious and jealous of anything that you had that I didn't. I still have problems with that. I'm better than I used to be. In sobriety, I began to learn a lot of things about gratitude, about a lot of the pain that happens in life. And this is where my son's come into play, because I had a lot of what we could call minor-type tragedies, although they're pretty big stuff, in my early years of sobriety and on through. And I want to tell you these to let you know that, not to get any sympathy, because I don't need sympathy and I don't want any sympathy, because we had some rough times. But to let you know that you don't have to drink no matter what happens to you. Stay close to the folks. And stay close to God. My youngest son was diagnosed with onset juvenile diabetes within 2 years after I was sober. My number two son, when he was 16 years old and I was about 4 years sober, was diagnosed with a Ewing sarcoma, which is one of the most deadly cancers known to man. Usually you live about 3 months with a Ewing sarcoma. He's alive and well today. He's one of the few people that's ever survived it. 2 years of chemotherapy that I went through with him sober. Those were the easy things. About 6 years ago, my number three son, who was very much involved in drinking and drugs from the time he was 12 or 13, had just gotten out of Peachtree Parkland Hospital, juvenile unit, and got with some of his drugging friends, and they ran out of money and they broke in my neighbor's house. They were seen and they knew they were seen, so they ran. They stole a car. That one broke down. They stole another one with somebody in it. And he was gone 2 weeks. And I knew not where he was. He finally came back and he turned himself in. He was charged with breaking and entry, armed robbery, grand theft auto, and kidnapping. And I had to send my 17-year-old son out to prison. And I could not do anything about that. Probably one of the most painful experiences I've ever been through in my whole life. Something totally out of my control. I learned from that a great deal. I learned that we grow through living through the pains of life sober. There's a fine lady at the Rivas Club, Johnny, who died recently and I had her funeral, but it was during that time that Johnny had said something about when does your program mean the most to you, and it's when you go through something hard and you come out on the other side sober. And I experienced that. I went through something hard, and I came out on the other side sober, and I came out a better man, and eternally grateful. But I didn't do it alone. I went through that period by going back to where I'd been when I first got out of the hospital. Lynn can remember I would go up to Regis Club, and I would go to the morning meeting. I'd sit around at night. In the afternoon, I'd go to the evening meeting. I stayed close to my people. Through all of that time, probably a good 3 months, we go back to our 90 and 90, and I wasn't doing it just doing 90 and 90. I went to where I was safe, where I was loved, and where I was comfortable. And we have such a great gift in AA, you know. When bad things happen in our lives, things that we might be ashamed of, and not want the neighbors to know about, I had a place where I could go and I could say, hey, you know, I got some bad stuff in my life. And I'd go and I'd tell folks this, and they'd say, that's okay. That got me through. That got me through the pain. I read something in the meditation book I've got about Painter Renoir, and I wanted to share that because it seemed to apply here. That Renoir had arthritis and rheumatism so bad he could hardly paint without constant pain. They even built a seat for him to sit on and raise and lower his seat in the canvas because he couldn't stand and move that much. And his students said, why do you do all of this? Why do you keep going through all of this pain? And he gazed at one of his favorite canvases and said, the pain goes away, but the beauty endures. And I think that's true. That the pain that we go through in life adds a beauty to our lives, a strength to our life, and a gratefulness to our life. And back to gratitude again. One of the things, after I'd been sober about 5 or 6 years, and I was working with this drunk in my church, and he'd been sober 7 years, and he'd been drunk 7 years, and all of a sudden it occurred to me, a lot of people get drunk at 5 or 7 years sober. And then it occurred to this old brain up here, Bob, you got 5 or 6 years sober. You reckon you might have a relapse. That was the first time it occurred to me that I might have a relapse.
And here again, I realized, you know, some of the stuff that I did, I don't know how in the world I stayed so much. You know, I had such garbage in me. I realized that I had nothing to do with my sobriety. And my sobriety was a gift. I'd gone to meetings, and I'd halfway practiced the program, and I halfway prayed. I always say that God was merciful to me. I get paid to pray. Otherwise, I don't know if I'd do much of it. But you know, I'd halfway do everything in the program. But yet, here I am, so... And I don't deserve it. I really don't deserve sobriety. I didn't earn it. I hadn't worked that hard at it. But yet my sobriety is a gift to me. Life itself is a gift to me. And I know today a lot about what life is about, what new life is about that I used to preach about all the time, but now I know it from a first-hand more experience of being what we could say born again. Because those of us who have been in the depths and death of alcoholism and drug addiction are truly dead. And I was truly dead. Today I have life and I'm grateful for life. And I've learned this in amongst the fellowship about life and death. People die. I mentioned Johnny dying. And, we had several die. We had close friends that leave us. But you know, we don't grieve normally for those folks in AA who die. Because, you know, they die and my first sponsor, Bill Folsom, that used to get me out of jail and try and get me sober, he died after I'd been in the program about a year. The word came, Bill was dead. He had been out of town and said, Bill died, but he was sober. You know, death wasn't that important. Sobriety was. Because, you see, we've already died. The life we have today is a gift of life, and we don't really worry about death that much. We don't worry about hell that much either, hopefully, because nothing could be like where we were before. Nothing. And I have something else about people who don't make it in the program, because I've had a lot of dear friends who just haven't been able to recover, and they die drunk. And I don't see their lives as wasted. I see their lives as a gift to me to help me stay sober. But I also see that there's hope for them. I've got this concept of sort of thing. They say this, in my house are many mansions, and I like to think that one of those mansions, one of those rooms in the mansion is the one with the big coffee pot in the sky. Where we're still getting sober and we're still growing spiritually. And it's a place for those who die to have some sort of recovery and peace and serenity and a life after. I believe that. And it's so for me. And that's all that's important. I learned an awful lot about the same old faith. I thought about the time when I was growing up, I was disgustingly moral. I was already self-righteous. I was had the Messiah complex that I've already talked about. And when you're living in this life of hiding from yourself, which I've always lived in a thing of not looking at who I am and where I am, one of the best places to hide from God is in church. Did you know that? Hide from God and hide from church. Now, here's the clincher on that. The best place in church to hide from God is to be preaching. And I did that for a number of years. Because he'll never find you there sometimes if you're really high. And so I've come to know that I may not have been devoid of faith and belief all of those years before when I was drinking. And I don't think I was. But I ceased to use that faith and that strength for me. Because the more I drank, I had my God in my body, you see. Spiritus full. And it provided me with all the spirituality I needed. So I've grown, I think, spiritually. I've rediscovered the God of my understanding. I've rediscovered my faith. I've rediscovered how to read the Bible from reading between the lines, like it says there, which you can do these. Like the first 12-step call is in the Bible. You know that, don't you? The story of the Good Samaritan, when the fellow is coming back from the trip and he falls among thieves and he's beat up and laying in a ditch and everybody passes him by. And then there's somebody, the Good Samaritan, picks him up and carries him to the inn. Now, this is where I know this is a 12-step call, is when he takes him to the inn, cleans him up and gives him something to eat, and he goes and tells the innkeeper, if you spend any more on him, I'll pay you when I get back. He doesn't leave him a dime. First 12-step call, right? Now, with St. Paul's conversion, you know, you've been struck by blindness on the road somewhere. Paul was on the road to Damascus, blind. I don't talk about being blind drunk. They took him to a little town in Emmaus over there. How long did they keep him at this friend's house? 3 days. How long does it take to detox? 3 days. All sorts of clues. And Paul talked about his thorn in the flesh and all that. That's so for me. You said which an hour 9 o'clock, and I'm gonna quit. I hope all of you who are in treatment in the hospital now will not try and do it by yourself when you get out. We can't do anything alone. We can't do anything without those who understand us and support us and hold us up. I got, if anybody could, I could. And I could. And I had a lot of relapses. And I discovered that only by turning my life and my will over to God and to you folks. I had to turn it over to you folks a long time before I turned it over to God. But God's in you. Always say, if you don't find God in other people, you ain't going to find him anywhere. And that's true. So, when you get out, don't try to. Stay with your folks. Because we share a secret. We share a marvelous secret. That we're all in it together. And we're all fragile. And we all have needs for one another. And this is a marvelous secret that we share. It's the only place in the world I know where this happens. Like it should. I thank God for helping me stay sober another day.